Well, thank you all for coming, first and foremost. It's a real thrill for me to be on this campus because when, at the same time as Dean Anderson, I was studying at AUC, we were all down on the Tahrir campus and there was no idea of anything else. And it's a truly splendid achievement in construction, and it's going to make, I think, a very significant difference to Egypt and beyond Egypt, to the region and to the world. I have another connection with Dean Anderson, which is that I used to be an adjunct in the program she was dean of, the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, of which I have warm memories, and I basically loved my 4 years in Egypt from 1976 to 1980. I left part of my heart behind me in this country, so whenever I come back to this country, my heart sings, and I wanted as soon as possible to see the new AUC campus and be as proud of it as I'm sure you all are. IDRC, I'll just say a couple of words about it because some of you may one day intersect with it, be funded by it, or even work for it. It's strictly a funding institution. We fund evidence-based research that aims to be policy relevant in a variety of fields touching on development. They can go from water management to information technologies for development, to strict economics, to even some work in the area of peace and conflict, which we think of as relevant to development. We operate all over the developing world. We have a regional office in Cairo. Over the years, many AUC alums have worked with it. Our current regional director is with us today, Eglal Rashid, and for us, this regional office is an important one. It covers all of the Middle East and North Africa, and for the past 2 days, we've been discussing with a number of people from the region what our funding priorities should be over the next 5 years. As IDRC, I'll be spending about $1 billion over the next 5 years strictly on research funding. It's important that we get our priorities right, and we'll only get them right if we listen to people on the ground, because they're the ones who know what the challenges are. We often imagine an ordering of priorities which probably wouldn't fit the region at all. As the president was saying, the food price spike was very much in the news until about 7 months ago. Since then, you haven't heard a word about it, probably. And likewise in the rest of the world. Why do I think it's worth discussing today? Because I think it will be back. In fact, I'm quite certain it will be back, and I'm going to try to convince you that it's likely to be back, and that for many people, it's a very important issue. If you're rich, if you're from a rich country, or you're rich in a poor country, or even middle class in a poor country, food price rises are manageable. If you're rich, you just outbid other bidders for whatever food you need. If you're poor, food is the single most important economic factor in your life. If you think of a family in Canada with, say, an income of $40,000, they will spend somewhere between 5 and 12% of their household budget on food. So not very much, and if food prices go up, well, they can absorb that or slightly change the menu. In a poor country, for a family that has a per capita, has a family income of, say, $800, which in some places is quite a good income for a poor family, 50% of their household budget goes on food. So imagine the price of food escalating very sharply for a family already spending 50% of their household budget on food, and you get an idea, or you begin to imagine, what the knock-on effects might be. What would you do to adapt? Well, you'd change the menu, and you'd move towards cheaper, but nearly in direct correlation, less nutritious food. And less nutritious food, by the way, means forms of malnutrition and stunting for children, which is a process that we like to forget about, but it goes on all around us. And the effects of stunting are lifelong. If you're stunted at the age of 5, you'll be living with the consequences for the rest of your life. So a change in menu isn't a lifestyle choice. It's for the poor, pregnant with consequence, all of it negative. But say you change the menu, you compress, but still, if you shift your food consumption patterns to the cheapest product, the share in the household budget is going to rise to perhaps 70%. You've got 30% left for all your other needs. So what, for example, will happen then as a knock-on effect? Well, one of them will be no private tuition for kids. We know that the poor in countries like Egypt, like India, the very poor, often save up a few rupees or a pound or two to provide private tuition to their kids because they know how poor public education can be. Particularly public education serving the poor tends to be not very desirable. Sometimes kids get pulled out of school and put to work. If things are bad enough, that's what happens. And once you've been pulled out of school at the age of 8 or 9, it's really difficult to go back to school, partly because you'll have missed quite a bit. Nobody wants to be in school with kids a lot younger. There are all sorts of reasons to believe that being pulled out of school for a year or two when you come from a poor family is generally definitive. So this is why for poor people, and Egypt has a lot of them, food prices are an urgent question. What attracted the attention of the bourgeoisie, of course, was disorder, riots, unhappiness. This is inconvenient. This is embarrassing. For the poor, it's much worse than inconvenient and embarrassing. It's the very foundations of their lives and of their kids' lives that are at stake when food prices rise very sharply, as they did all over the developing world early last year and in late 2007. Parenthesis, food prices didn't rise in Canada at all. Why? It's rich enough that the economy actually cushioned the rise of basic food prices. But in countries like Egypt, India, China, others, it was a very noticeable development. Now, when I say that food prices rising can be a major problem for poor families, to give you an idea of how major it was, because most of us have forgotten that, the price of rice increased by 400%. In a period of about 2 years leading up to the summer of 2008, putting rice way beyond the means of populations in India and China, notably, for whom rice was a preferred staple. Well, that was completely out. What else is out when you are facing steep price rises? Meat, and meat, of course, is central in terms of protein intake. So those price rises were extremely steep. What could have caused the spike in prices? Well, The first thing to say is that stocks internationally had been gradually dwindling over a 10-year period. Agricultural production had continued to grow, and to a small degree, even agricultural productivity had been continuing to grow. But the factor with which agriculture didn't keep up was the growing middle class in much of the world. The middle class eats differently from the poor. And if you have a growing middle class, as notably China had a growing middle class, then consumption patterns change completely. Consumption of cereals actually dropped in China over the last 10 years. But consumption of meat was up 250%. Consumption of fruit was up 300%. And I could go on and on listing the products that Chinese are consuming a great deal more of today, and which have had the effect of pulling down international stocks. As you probably all know, to produce livestock that eventually provide meat, grain is an essential input in much of the world. And so in order to produce a kilo of meat, you actually have enormous input of grains of various sorts. So meat is a luxury item in many ways, not just in its price, but also by the inputs required to produce it. So rice was the most spectacular rise in price, but wheat, which provides important staples in India, rose by about 300% over a period of about 18 months as well. Now, does this induce panic in a country like Egypt? Not necessarily on the face of it, because Egypt's actually, unnoticed by many Egyptians, done quite a good job of growing agriculture. Agriculture has actually developed in this country a lot over the last 30 years, and Egypt today produces 60% of the wheat it needs and nearly 70% of the cereals it needs. But for the remaining 40%, it's reliant on international markets. And rises in prices beyond the products that are subsidized in Egypt by the government give rise to high anxiety, as some of you will remember, amongst the poor. So India, Egypt, in a gradual way, unspectacular way, has been successful at growing agriculture, and it's done this in spite of severe limitations on water, as you know, and a number of other limitations on this country that countries like India and China don't face. But let's think of India and China for a second and how they went about their basic economic reforms. It's hard for many of you to imagine today how poor China was in 1970, because various Maoist economic experiments were disastrous in different ways and had left the country with a growing population, a very large growing population, flat on its back. The first generation of reformists in China decided to start with agriculture. Interesting idea. And they decided not to start with a World Bank plan or a Communist Party plan. Deng Xiaoping decided that it was only by experimenting with what worked in terms of trying to build agricultural production rather than a top-down approach that China would succeed, something very new for China under the communist regime. And so the Chinese learned by doing, and this was the design. They tried all sorts of different things. Deng Xiaoping had a lovely expression for it, crossing the river while feeling the stones. And that describes very graphically how tentative the Chinese approach was, but also how determined they were to establish what would work and then put the full weight of the Chinese state behind what worked. And that's what they did. And they managed to reduce poverty, outright poverty, in China from about 35% of the population to less than 5% of the population over a 10-year period by putting the countryside productively to work in all sorts of ways that were very challenging to communist ideology. Deng Xiaoping was no ideologue. India, on the other hand, participated in and led in many ways with some other countries the Green Revolution of the 1960s and 1970s. It had to do with something Egypt's been quite good at, hybridizing seeds and just developing higher and higher yield plants that can feed more and more people. So this was India's way out of a disastrous economic situation in the mid-60s. And for Indians, agriculture is important because during the sainted Raj period, the British presided in their last 10 years in charge of India over two famines that took millions of lives in the south of India and millions of lives in West Bengal a bit later. So the memory of famine, starvation, millions dying from starvation is deeply ingrained in the Indian DNA. So any government worth its salt in India is going to want to keep that severity of food crisis at bay. And they were again reaching a point of non-self-sufficiency by the mid-60s. But what happened in the wake of the success of the Green Revolution in many countries like India was politicians thought, well, we've solved that, we'll move on to the next challenge. But they hadn't solved it lastingly because some of the improvements were brought about by irresponsible use of water, unsustainable use of water, and by new fertilizers which used to excess turned out to be toxic chemical fertilizers, and which the Indian system simply didn't deal with. Such that after an initial burst of agricultural productivity growth in the late 60s and 70s, it slowed right down again as of the 1980s. So India was ripe for a food supply and pricing crisis by the early years of this century. Parenthesis, in this particular food crisis and in the economic crisis which will affect India and particularly the poor in India, will India fare worse than China? Perhaps not, because one thing the Chinese discarded was social policy during the years of frenzied enthusiasm for market-based economic production. The social safety net in China disappeared virtually during those years. There is hardly any social safety net in China, whereas India, because of the long experience of poverty and a political system that's democratic and needs to listen to the poor, who are the electorate of India, provides many programs that will help cushion the blow for Indians during the current crisis. So Integral to my tale is the fact that agricultural productivity growth all over the world after the Green Revolution of the 60s and 70s trailed off, and rice production over the last 10 years didn't grow at all, while the number of rice consumers grew very greatly. Big problem. You add to that problem climate change. Now, I'm not a climate change alarmist, but you don't have to be a climate change alarmist to realize that climate change is very likely to affect principally the developing world. Much of the industrialized world will do quite well out of climate change in terms of agricultural production. Think of Canada. Much of our snow and ice will melt, and we'll be able to put that land to use for the first time. But for countries like Egypt, like Kenya, like India, the prospects are much more bleak. The best estimate is that in terms of agricultural production and how it's impacted by climate change, in years to come, the developing world will lose to climate change anywhere between 3 and 7% of its potential, while the industrialized world will probably gain somewhere around 3%. How does that affect this area? We don't know. We'd like to know, but we simply don't know. We don't know how the sources of the Nile will be fed 15 or 20 years from now. We don't know how hard global warming will hit this area. It just hasn't been studied a lot. So public policy types tend to apply to the Middle East. Their template for the world as a whole, or their template for other regions. But on the Middle East, we simply don't have a lot of data. So the price rises, the recent price rises, what contributed to them? Weather conditions, and that's why I mentioned climate change before mentioning these causes. A drought in Australia, notably, had a great deal to do with less grain availability internationally. If we're going to be facing lots of droughts all over the world, I hardly need extrapolate. Financial speculation, by the way, may have had something to do. We're not sure, and it's disputed amongst economists and experts in agriculture, but because hedge funds and a number of other essentially speculative mechanisms attach themselves to the field of agriculture over the last 10 years, it may well be that these new financial mechanisms had something to do with an intensification of a phenomenon that was undergoing, that was ongoing anyway. You may have noticed the price of food rose at exactly the same time as the price of oil. Well, fuel is actually an input to agricultural production, so it accounts for about 15% of the cost of agricultural production. So if fuel is going up, you can be sure food prices will. Biofuels. Enthusiasm for biofuels, and here the United States and Canada may have contributed significantly to the crisis. Again, we're not quite sure to what extent. The U.S. Department for Agriculture claims not at all, but many independent economists and experts believe that the sharp shift from wheat and corn production to the production of cereals that would lend themselves to biofuel was a shock to the system that helped induce the spike. Interestingly, in North America, both Canada and the United States, the stampede into biofuels is being very much questioned today and is being reviewed in both countries. A reduction in agricultural research funding probably had quite a bit to do with this latest spike, because no longer being the issue of the day after the Green Revolution, funding for agricultural research fell off progressively in spite of the best efforts of our institution, the Rockefeller Foundation, which has a particular vocation for agricultural research, and a number of other traditional funders of agricultural research. Trade policy around the world. Fierce subsidies for agricultural production in the United States and in Europe, and I'm ashamed to say in some sectors in Canada, and the disadvantage at which that put much of the developing world had a great deal, we know, to do with the crisis, although the specifics of it are debatable across the board. Nobody doubts that a successful round, trade round, a successful conclusion of the Doha round of trade discussions would immensely help agriculture internationally and would help stabilize markets. Finally, environmental degradation. I mentioned excessive use of chemical fertilizers in India. I mentioned unsustainable use of water in India also, but this has been a global phenomenon, of course. And we're facing the limits of our capacity in many parts of the world to abuse the global commons. And while we tend to think of water mainly in terms of personal use, in most of the world, the vast majority of fresh water goes to agricultural use. So agriculture is the main user and abuser of water internationally. And that was glossed over by policymakers all over the world. And Egypt, for example, I think still has a lot of work to do on water use in agriculture, how to recycle more water, and how to use what water is used more rationally than it currently does. Now, which of these causes were the most important? We simply don't know. In preparation of this lecture, I was rereading a lot of material by world-famous experts. They simply don't agree amongst themselves. So you take your pick of the mix of these factors I mentioned, which are the principal ones cited by various experts, and your guess is as good as mine. Now, one thing that happened during the food price spike was that several countries worried about self-sufficiency, India and Egypt amongst them, banned exports of a number of products. Perfectly understandable, but not wise in global terms. Why do I say that? Countries even poorer than India and Egypt were the principal victims of this. It wasn't countries like Canada, because again, we can outbid Uganda down the Nile, or we can outbid Nepal for food. But it was the poorest countries that lost from trade distorting measures, because it simply took more food off the table available for purchase and trade. And while most countries lifted their export bans quickly, Egypt and India didn't. So while it's perfectly understandable why Egypt's politicians and India's politicians took the steps they did in response to widespread anxiety in their countries over food availability, frankly, it wasn't a great idea in terms of the rest of the world. Now, what's happened since about June of last year, when oil started plunging and food prices started plunging? First of all, because we've gone into an economic and financial crisis, demand for food is actually beginning to diminish. People can't afford to waste much food now, And people are simply eating less in much of the world as economic conditions deteriorate, and that will have nutritional consequences for kids I mentioned earlier. Now, will this lead to neglect of agriculture? Because politicians will think, well, you know, there's no surplus of demand, and the prices have fallen? Almost certainly, because agricultural production and productivity growth requires long-term planning and long-term investment. It cannot respond to short-term stimuli. It can in terms of if you have an empty field, you can grow some wheat on it for next year. But globally, it's something that requires long-term attention and commitment, and that's exactly what we're beginning to lack at the moment. And because for Egyptians, food supply, food prices are so sensitive for the 20% of Egyptians who are outright under the poverty line, for the 20% of Egyptians who are just above the outright poverty line, and for the further 20% of Egyptians who are somewhere between poverty and being able to join the lower middle class, all of this is tremendously important. And some of you may choose to work in this field. It's a tremendously exciting field on which I'm not an expert at all. I've just taken an interest in it in recent months, because it struck me as something that was very important. Why will the pressures on agriculture continue? The world population is going to continue rising. By 2050, there will probably be 9 billion of us. These people are going to be, by and large, richer, we hope. Their consumption patterns will be more like Chinese consumption patterns than Indian consumption patterns today. So we know the demand for food is going to go on growing steadily. We also know that urbanization is a major fact of life in the world today. Egyptians see that all around them, and everywhere in the developing world we see an onset of urbanization. Urbanization is not in and of itself a bad thing, but urbanization brings with it a number of shifts in consumption patterns and also, to a degree, pressure on production. All of this, by the way, feeds anxiety, nervousness over food supply. That, in turn, can feed instability in any political system, and in the most severe cases, can create violence, as we saw over the year from mid-2007, mid-2008. Overall, am I optimistic for Egypt? Yes, because it has done a much better job than most Egyptians credit their own country for in inducing significant agricultural growth in this country over the last 30 years or so. It's a triumph for Egypt to be able to produce 60% of its wheat when 30 or 40 years ago it produced only 25% of what it needed for many fewer people. So please don't be downhearted about Egypt's performance in this field. But because of population growth in Egypt, because of remaining severe poverty in sectors of Egypt's population, the country simply has to go on doing better and better in agricultural production in a situation where its own water supply is not unduly alarming, but uncertain, where water use isn't ideal, as we all know, where reclaiming more land for agricultural purposes will require, frankly, better and longer term public policy, and where land use in terms of fragmentation of land holdings will need to be addressed also in years ahead. But I am tremendously optimistic for this country. It's done with a limited deck of cards pretty well over the past 30 years. The quality of its human capital is exceptional. Egyptians who settle around the world inevitably do very, very well. Egyptians have produced real gains for their own country in recent years, and thus there's every reason to be optimistic about the future of Egypt, including in the field of agriculture. But it's a real challenge ahead. So thank you very much for your attention on all of that. And in the question and answer period, I'm happy to answer other questions, questions relating to development funding generally, or development as a discipline, or international relations, whatever you have on your minds. So thank you.